This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about the recent passing of our dear friend and colleague, Ellen Ray.
A life spent fighting for the underdog, fighting against imperialism, fighting to expose secrets, and fighting to support revolution. We sorely miss Ellen.
We'll also talk about the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta.
All our dignitaries and officials are at Runnymede. It's like a Roman circus over there. Why are they celebrating? Is it meaningful? And what message should we, as progressives, take from the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta?
We'll also talk about some recent victories in the case of Stephen Salida.
Remember, the professor fired from a tenure job at University of Illinois, but he's winning and making progress.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Smith and Michael Ratner, we had some very sad news last week. Your dear friend Ellen Ray has passed away.
She died on June 11th. She was 75. She had come to New York as a young woman from Grand Island, Nebraska, and accomplished just a lot of good stuff. Michael, talk to us about what Ellen did when she got here.
Well, when she got here, complicated, of course, but the first thing she did was go off, at least from a political point of view that I knew about, was go off to Okinawa during the Vietnam War. And she went off with her then partner, eventual husband, Bill Shapp, who we've interviewed on this show a number of times, and lawyers you'll like, etc. But she went off to Okinawa, and their job was defending GIs accused of various crimes. The particular crime that a number were accused of, and I know Michael Smith is aware of it, perhaps Heidi, fragging. Fragging is when an enlisted person rolls a grenade into the tent of their superior officer, usually a lieutenant, a second lieutenant, and of course kills him. And it was constant. I mean, this was, you know, people did not like being in Vietnam. They didn't like being ordered into battle when they know they'd be killed in Vietnam. And so they defended a number of those people. And I actually, when I was at the center, I handled the appeals from those cases. Sometimes they got convicted, sometimes they didn't. Oftentimes they got long sentences, but the appeals courts always were relatively generous. You don't find any of those people, as I recall, serving life sentences. They got reduced to 10 years, etc. But in any case, that was the first phase of Ellen's political life that I became aware of in the 70s, was living in Okinawa and defending GIs with her partner, husband, William Shapp.
What about covert action?
Well, the next phase, I think, that was very important in her life and has come down to influence us very heavily today was her beginning to work with Philip Agee. Philip Agee was a former CIA agent who wrote an important book called Inside the Company that exposed 200-some agents who were overthrowing democracy and creating counter-revolution in Central and South America. He was the first huge whistleblower in the agency, and you could look at him as sort of a precursor for Chelsea Manning, WikiLeaks, Snowden, etc. In any case, they put out a magazine together. It was called Covert Action Information Bulletin. Let's remember, this is in the 70s and 80s. This is before there was a prohibition on naming CIA agents. So what they did was figure out who were the CIA agents around the world. And it was relatively straightforward. You could look at the biographies that were published about people. You could look at their office or their job in the U.S. embassies around the world. You could look at where they went to school, a number of ways. And they had a column in the back of Covert Action Information Bulletin, I think it was a quarterly, that listed the names of scores of CIA agents. I mean, in the end, it was hundreds of CIA agents. And they were listed there. And they not only did that, they actually used that information, or gave people used it, in a way, for example, I vaguely recall, I don't know if it was Ellen in particular, but when Michael Manley was running for Prime Minister of Jamaica, he had won once, and the U.S. government and the CIA put up against him a man named Sayaga.
They called him Sayaga.
Sayaga, right. It was in the early 80s, and they tried to get him to win, obviously. And one of the things that happened is the CIA station chief in Jamaica was exposed. I forgot who did it, but at a public press conference in Jamaica, with the statement of saying, this is the CIA station chief, he's trying to make sure Michael Manley, the progressive, doesn't win, etc. So the information wasn't just published. It was used, essentially, so that CIA agents could not engage in the dirty work of assassinations, overthrowing unions, overthrowing governments, stopping revolutions, etc. Incredibly important magazine. Phil Agee, of course, an incredibly important figure in American history. Anyway, that went on. I was their lawyer. This is Michael Ratner speaking. I was their lawyer during this period. And I remember in 1979 or 1980, the government got annoyed with them.
Annoyed, Michael?
Well, very angry. This was an angering thing, publishing the names of CIA agents. And they passed what is now known as the Agents' Identities Protection Act. And I won't go through all the details, but suffice to say, the work of Bill and Ellen, Ellen Ray, who we're talking about, who passed away on June 11th of this year, the work of Bill and Ellen, Phil Schaap, Lou Wolf was also one of the editors of that magazine, was stopped in its tracks. Because that law said you couldn't name agents. Not you couldn't just name agents if you were inside the agency with a security clearance, but you couldn't name agents even if you were a publisher, which was Bill and Ellen were. In other words, you couldn't do it. And it's certainly squarely against the First Amendment, in my view. They said you couldn't name them if it was part of a process of exposing agents. You still technically are authorized to name an agent if it's part of a news-gathering process in which it's necessary to understand the article that you're writing. But of course, because it prosecutes people for naming agents, it chills almost anybody naming them. You will see them occasionally. Anyway, covert action would certainly be one of the highlights, I think, of Ellen Schaap's career.
Yeah, but she was just picking up speed, Michael. She and Bill went on to start a magazine called Lies of Our Times, the acronym for LOOT. And it dealt with just that, the misinformation and the lack of information and the twisting of information and the general crookedness of the New York Times as it prints all the news that's fit to print. It was an excellent piece of really underground journalism.
That was the successor magazine to Covert Action Information Bulletin. You know, I still meet people today who just loved both of those magazines.
Well, I did.
Right. For sure. And there were articles in them. They didn't just list agents. There were articles really taking on the United States and its imperialism.
And then she made a movie, Michael. Talk about that.
Was it called Stand Up for Grenada?
Yeah.
The movie was called Stand Up for Grenada. And actually, Ellen and I and Bill had gone to Grenada early on. In fact, Bill Schaap was one of the lawyers for the people who ultimately made the Grenada Revolution. Here's what happened. The Grenada Revolution succeeds March 13th, 1979, before even the Nicaraguan Revolution, which is July 1979. And it's led by Maurice Bishop, Bernard Cord, and some others, called the New Jewel Movement. At the same time, in 1979 or even 78, a number of people from Grenada were indicted, or at least not indicted. There was a grand jury sitting in Washington because some people had been caught gun running to the leaders of the New Jewel Movement in Grenada, if I have my facts right. Bill Schaap, Ellen's partner, was one of the lawyers for those people. So when the Grenadian Revolution succeeded and Maurice Bishop became essentially the head of it, we went down there to visit with them, see them, etc. I was present for the first anniversary of the Grenadian Revolution, which you have to just go back to that. It's March 13th, 1980. And I remember I was sitting there almost in the front row with Ellen and Bill. Ellen, who was, of course, very important to it. And there on the stage, the three people were Maurice Bishop, who was the head of the Grenada, the New Jewel Movement. Daniel Ortega came from El Salvador and presented a gun to Maurice Bishop, a rifle. And Michael Manley was there from Jamaica. So it was an incredibly historic occasion. You would have sat there in 1980 and said, look what's going on. Cuba is free. Grenada is free. Nicaragua is free. I meant Daniel Ortega from Nicaragua, if I spoke right. El Salvador was on the verge of winning. You would have said there was revolution spreading throughout that part of the hemisphere.
Well, there was. That's why Reagan did what he did. saying there was a fake crisis at the medical school in Grenada, sending American troops, closing it all down. American wars.
It's true. In Ellen's film, which was made a year after the Grenada Revolution, so roughly in 1980 sometime, was a film not just about Grenada, but about U.S. efforts to destabilize Grenada. And I remember when Reagan took office, Sal Landau made a film, I think it was called Target Grenada or something. And it was, you know, Reagan would go, our president at the time, President Reagan, would go on TV and there'd be a big target over Grenada or something, or a big, see all the shipping lanes in the Caribbean go past Grenada. It's our oil ship lines. You know, Grenada is this like tiny place of like 90,000 people.
Yeah, but it was 90,000 black people, many of whom were socialists.
And it was very close to Cuba. Let's understand that at the time Grenada was invaded in 1983, the Cubans defended the new airport they were building for the Grenadians.
With their lives.
With their lives. Hmm. Heroic stand against the American invasion. So Ellen's life was very involved, the best way to say it, which is the revolutionary traditions of the best people in this country, and a life of anti-imperialism, an incredible life.
But she's not done. She was the president of Sheridan Square Press. Sheridan Square Press published a book that I and my wife Debbie read immediately when it came off the press about Jim Garrison, the New Orleans district attorney, wrote a book on the Trail of the Assassins. And it was Garrison that showed that the murder of John Kennedy was a conspiracy. It wasn't one lone nut named Lee Harvey Oswald, not at all. It was Ellen that not only published that book, but then she cornered Oliver Stone in an elevator, and she got him interested in the book, and Stone wound up collaborating with Zach Sklar, who wrote the script. The movie won an Oscar, the movie JFK. That was Ellen Ray's responsibility.
Where else would it? Where was Ellen Ray going to corner Oliver Stone in an elevator? You know, it wasn't going to
L.A.
be not L.A. It was going to be the Cuban Film Festival, which is where it was. She happens to get in the elevator in one of the few hotels in Havana, and there's Oliver Stone. Of course, Ellen Ray was irrepressible. Let me just say that she was an amazing character, completely alive till the very end of her life. Irrepressible is the best word for her, and she cornered Oliver in the elevator at the. I don't know, it would have been the Nacional was the hotel that people stayed in Cuba at that time.
I think you and Karen Ranucci summed it up well, Michael, when you said that she was really the precursor to WikiLeaks before there were computers. She was that kind of a fundamental, groundbreaking journalist.
Yes, she was, and very important. We sorely miss her. So we're speaking about Ellen Ray, who died last week, June 11th, at 75 years old. We send our condolences to her family, and particularly her partner, Bill Shapp, who you would have to say were two wings of the same bird in terms of both exposing secrets that should not be kept secret and in taking on United States imperialism around the world.
Ellen Ray, presente.
Michael Ratner, we're celebrating the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta. What does that mean to us?
Big hoopla. All our Supreme Court justices, the Queen of England, all our courts, everybody is saying, wow, 800 years of Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence coming out of the Magna Carta.
They're all over there in England at Runnymede yesterday celebrating it.
Anyway, 800 years, it's 1215 is the year that it was signed. It was signed, or it wasn't really signed, but it was sealed. We're not sure King John could write, but he sealed the Magna Carta, which was a demand made by barons. There had been a fight going on between the king and barons. And at Runnymede, they finally agreed to a settlement. More on that later, but they agreed to a settlement. And that's what became the Great Charter or the Magna Carta. Now, people would say we looked at it, and of course we used it in Guantanamo, because part of the Magna Carta, even though it's a distribution of power between the king and the barons, does have a couple of clauses in there that have come down to be very important today. When I say it's a distribution of power, the one part that is important on that distribution is the barons basically said the king is not the absolute ruler and can't do whatever he wants. One thing it definitely stands for is authority under law, that authority is to be under law. Now, just as an aside, as we talk about it standing for authority under law, and then we'll get to Guantanamo and everything else, the ABA, which is the American Bar Association, also is a big deal, and they're all about the Magna Carta, and they're all
over there, too.
Yeah, they're all over there. The less that are here, the better. But they're all, especially of those particular ones, they're all over in London, or in England. It's a few miles north of London, maybe 20. And they have a plinth, which is what is basically a column of marble, sticking at Runnymede on the site where the Magna Carta ought to be. And what that says is freedom under law. Well, think about that, guys. Is that the same as authority under law? No, it's not. It's freedom under law. It's not saying authority under law, which is a good thing to have. It's freedom. So it means that our freedom and your freedom and people who were hitting the streets like 50,000 of us on Ferguson, that we maybe shouldn't be doing that. We shouldn't be crossing streets, shutting down traffic, because that's against the law.
So it's saying that the rule of law must govern.
Right. Basically, it's a rule of law statement.
Whose law?
Right. It's a, and what about revolution? What about laws that are unjust? And it's interesting, the year they put that up, ABA, American Bar Association, put that freedom under law up, was the same year, I think, same year, roughly the same year that they changed May 1st from Labor Day to Law Day. If not the same year, around that time, certainly around the time they put under God in our Constitution.
Under God and the Pledge of Allegiance.
Under God and the Pledge of Allegiance. So basically it's looked at as a way of controlling, by the ABA and other, looked at as a way of controlling the population. That's one thing it does stand for. But the other thing it does stand for, we look at it as lawyers, is the origin of the writ of habeas corpus, which is the right to challenge your detention, the right to not be picked up in executive detention. Let's just talk about that for a second without too many details. Executive detention is when the president just picks you up by the scruff of the neck, or the king does, tosses you into a prison and says, bye-bye, no court, nothing. Now, that actually wasn't the Magna Carta. You weren't allowed to be executively detained, disappeared, essentially. Now, we used it in the Guantanamo cases. We used the Magna Carta directly.
Okay, question. Are we allowed to cite the Magna Carta as a body of law?
We cite it really not as law itself, but as something that is very important in our legal system. And when we did the Guantanamo cases, which, as people recall, are just people being picked up by a president all over the world and tossed into Guantanamo with no right to go to court, we went to court. And what's interesting is we won that case, surprisingly, 6-3 in the Supreme Court in 2004. And Justice Kennedy, who I recall wrote that opinion, quoted directly from the Magna Carta, basically quoting another case, but quoting from the Magna Carta, saying executive detention is anathema in the United States. Since the Magna Carta, since King John at Runnymede, we do not have a place for executive detention. So it does still have some current efficacy and use. But when you look at the big hoopla being made about it, and you think there's still 120 or 116, as we speak, people left at Guantanamo, there's 2 million prisoners in the United States, and we're torturing people, which again is a prohibition that came out of Magna Carta, or at least as it went on, the U.S. is violating every single understanding of what the Magna Carta and certainly its later understanding meant.
Let's talk about its sister.
Right. There was a sister at the same time, which I'm sure almost no one listening to this is hearing. There was an acquaintance of ours named Peter Linebaugh, who's a professor who wrote a book on the Magna Carta, which I recommend, because what it talks about is, yes, Magna Carta is important, etc., but let's talk about a charter that was written roughly at the same time, and a couple of years later perhaps, but starting at that same time, and it's called the Charter of the Forest. The Charter of the Forest is one that doesn't just guarantee juridical rights, as the Magna Carta does, you know, the right to not be thrown in prison, the right to, you know, be treated fairly, the right to be treated without torture, etc., but the right to economic survival. Mm. And the right to what was called back then the commons, which meant that people living out in villages had a right to go into the forest and cut the timber they needed which is like a fuel for that time. It's like oil today, and that's an important analogy, that timber was looked at as belonging to the commons, the pasture. You could put your cow on the pasture. That was fought for very heavily by people, and that's called the Charter of the Forest. Very, very important. And that's something that, of course, you'll never hear about in the United States, because that's talking about economic survival.
In medieval times, before the advent of capitalism, before the advent of its latest phase, neoliberalism, people, of course, had various stations in life. You had the aristocracy, and you had certain merchants, and you had a vast peasant class. And there were mutual obligations between these people and different stations of life. So there was a social pact, really, that the aristocracy had pledged to take care of the people who lived on their lands. And, of course, it wasn't a total welfare system. I'm not romanticizing it at all. But the point is that old system was totally overthrown with the advent of capitalism. Human nature was transformed in the 16th and 17th century. And that Charter of the Forest, where people were able to have wealth in common, they were looked out after to a certain extent, that was all blown away. And instead, you had people driven from the forest, from the villages, into the cities, into those dismal shops where they worked 16 hours a day, no light, bad food, died young. This is what we're talking about when we talk about the Industrial Revolution and the lands that they held in common where they could put their cows and sheep. Those were all enclosed to help drive out these people into the cities. So there was a huge transformation in the human personality in the 16th and 17th century, and that was an aspect of the destruction of the Charter of the Forests.
Right, and so Peter Lanbaugh wants to bring back the concepts of the Charter of the Forest when he talks about petroleum. He says petroleum is essentially a modern-day forest, and that ought to be, apart from the global warming issues we now have, but ought to be the rights of all people in the world. You shouldn't privately be able to control petroleum. So that's a good example of how the Charter of Forest could be used. It can't be privatized. The laws Michael Smith is referring to were called enclosure laws, and they closed off the forest, they closed off the meadows, etc. Peter Lanbaugh, in another book called London Hanged, which is an extraordinary book, talks about, he looked at every single hanging in 16th century London or in England. There were hundreds of them. 98%, perhaps higher, were all for economic crimes.
Sure.
And they all were based on people's belief that they still had a right to the commons. I'll give you one good example. A guy comes in maybe from the countryside and he gets a job in London. As you said, Michael, they were forced to get jobs as workmen in guilds then, but eventually incipient capitalism. And he's cutting material for people's vests out of leather. So it's on a table and he takes a scissors, chop, chop, chop all around, and leather drops onto the floor. And so what does the worker cutter do? He figures that's like the gleaning in a field. Gleaning, which you all know from biblical concepts as well as from what we're talking about here, is when you reap a field and the corners are left for poor people so they can glean or take the grains from the poor. Well, he figured, I'm cutting this leather and these pieces that can't be used enough for a vest anymore. So the cutter worker takes those pieces of leather and takes them home and is able to do something with them or sell them or something. Well, under what was feudalism, that would have been allowed. Under
yeah,
what was
coal, wood, oh, sure.
Under what was incipient capitalism or the beginnings of that period, it wasn't allowed. And those were the people that were hung in London. And they were hung to reinforce the message that you are now a wage worker. You have no right to this property, no right to these goods, no right to this leather, no right to these woods as a working person.
Query, was the Charter of the Forest formally revoked, or are you saying that just the economic changes rendered it obsolete for those intents?
It's a good question. My guess is it wasn't formally revoked, just like the Magna Carta has clauses in it that were not formally revoked.
How fascinating, Michael.
It is fascinating. It was a whole part of the reworking of the human personality. Prisons were a part of it. Religion was a part of it. People were told that they had to work those long, dreary hours, and they would get their reward in heaven.
Instruments of oppression.
Yeah, it was part of the whole ideological package to impose really wage slavery right. on a population that had been free living in the countryside.
Right. You know, when we talk about issues on this show, and we often talk about Cuba, and we look at Cuba as initially guaranteeing primarily economic rights, the right to food, the right to education,
healthcare.
The right to health care, the right to housing, et cetera, perhaps stressing less on what we call civil and political rights in right. the United States, which is the right to speech, the right to vote, whatever those are, although you have those in Cuba. And that's the divide, if you look at it. It's the same divide between the Magna Carta and the Charter of the Forest. Magna Carta is embraced by the United States officialdom and the powers that be as the be and end all, which is to say, if I have the right to speak freely, then I shouldn't have to worry about where my children are going to school, where I get a shelter from, or where I get food from, because I have the ability to speak and change the government.
Right.
No economic guarantees. Cuba took the position that both were of equal importance and that you had to have economic rights to recognize and exercise political and civil rights. And that's the same divide we're talking about now with Magna Carta and the Charter of the Forest.
Michael Smith, I understand that Justice Scalia is once again in the news.
I love Scalia. I think, in a perverse way, my favorite judge. He's actually come out to say that God favors the death penalty. Anyway, Scalia was on the bench, and he was listing the dissenting judges in a case. And we got to Justice Ginsburg. He called her Justice Goldberg. Goldberg had been on the Supreme Court and retired in 1965. Anyway, when he said Goldberg instead of Ginsburg, Chief Justice Roberts said, "You made a mistake."
He whispered in his ear, didn't he?
He whispered in his ear. He said, "It's Ginsburg," which reminded me of an old joke about the guy that said that the Jews were responsible for the sinking of the Titanic. The other guy said, "What do you mean? Jews responsible. It was an iceberg. The Titanic hit an iceberg." And the guy said, "Iceberg, Goldberg, what's the difference?"
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
Today we want to bring you some important updates regarding the case of Stephen Salida. Stephen Salida, as you may recall from prior Law and Disorder shows, was about to take his 10-year job at the University of Illinois Urbana when he got fired. He got fired because of his impassioned defense of Palestinians and his criticism of the massive Gaza war that was killing thousands of Palestinians. He brought a lawsuit. In that lawsuit, he was represented and is represented by the Center for Constitutional Rights and a firm in Chicago called Lovey and Lovey. As part of the whole process of fighting back against the University of Illinois, lawyers filed a Freedom of Information Act request for all the letters sent to the University of Illinois regarding Stephen Salida. A lot of these most likely came from donors who were objecting to the hiring of Stephen Salida. We don't know yet, but last week a court gave an order that 9,000 emails had to be revealed to Stephen Salida and his lawyers. We'll talk about that victory. In addition, last week there was a meeting of the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors, and they censured the University of Illinois at Urbana for firing Stephen Salida. Here to talk about these developments and bring us up to date on the Stephen Salida case is Maria LaHood. Maria LaHood is the deputy legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights with an expertise in constitutional rights and international human rights law. She works to defend Palestinian human rights advocates in the United States, defending the Olympia Food Co-op board members for boycotting Israeli goods, a case concerning obtaining U.S. government records regarding Israel's 2010 attack on the flotilla to Gaza, and other legal support for Palestinian students and others whose speech is being suppressed for their Palestinian advocacy around the country. Her past work at CCR includes cases against drones, as well as Royal Dutch Shell for human rights violations in Nigeria.
Maria LaHood, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
We've had a couple of victories in the case of Stephen Salida. Can you describe what happened and their significance?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think for those who may not know who Professor Salida is, he had accepted a tenured position at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. This was last summer, about 2 weeks before he was set to start working, and he was basically sent a letter saying, don't show up. He was given no reason, certainly no opportunity to be heard. He had already quit his tenured position. His wife had quit her job. They had put money down on a condo in Illinois, and the movers were scheduled. The university later disclosed that he was terminated because of his tweets about the assault on Gaza last summer, after donors had threatened to withhold funds. That was disclosed in FOIA documents. We have and I can tell you more about the facts, but we have two cases against the university, one for his termination, and one is a FOIA case under the Freedom of Information Act in Illinois, essentially seeking the emails of university officials, which would include correspondence with donors. The university had argued that request was unduly burdensome, even though it had already released some documents, not all, but some documents under other FOIA requests that media have made and others. And we argued that whatever burden there is, even though there's not a big burden, the public interest in releasing the records certainly outweighs that burden.
It also seems strange.
Last Friday, the court agreed.
Sorry, Maria. I just wanted to say that it seems strange that it could be burdensome given the short period of time. I would imagine that trustees or other university officials would write to the administration. That's so time limited.
Right. It was not the not only was the date restriction was not large, the search terms were not many, it was ludicrous that they would argue that it was unduly burdensome, and the court agreed and ordered them to release the documents.
Maria, let me tell you what I suspect. I suspect, and this is based on one of the documents that was released a long time ago, by a Zionist heavy donor to the university, a local guy that I think was giving the university $200,000, threatened to withhold that money unless they fired Professor Salida. And I expect that in these documents there's going to be more, hot stuff like this.
I think you're probably right. I mean, they have, even in the documents that they have released, which has shown, yes, big donor has won, admittedly a six-figure donor, threatening to withhold future donations from the university because of Salida's hiring. We hope to find out more. And also, how the university handled it. Chancellor Weiss, not only didn't talk to Professor Salida, didn't even bother, engaging with the department that hired him, after a long, involved process. But she did make time to talk to donors and hear what they had to say about a few of his tweets prior to making her decision.
There was I don't know the details. I don't remember quite. But I think there was an organization in the Chicago area, maybe the Jewish Federation, that made a motion to ask that it not be a target of discovery. Help me out here.
It was the American Jewish Committee.
Yeah.
They sought leave to file an amicus brief as part of the university, or, to supplement the university's motion to dismiss the case. Besides suing the university and university officials, we also sued unnamed John Doe donors for interfering with the contract that Professor Salida had by, this quid pro quo of, we're going to withhold money unless you fire him, essentially. So we have not named donors yet, but American Jewish Committee came in seeking leave to file an amicus brief, arguing that the unnamed donor should be dismissed from the case.
That sounds like a smoking gun.
The court rejected that brief.
In response to the developments, I read a newspaper article where a university spokeswoman named Robin Kaler was interviewed, and she said that, quote, the school has, quote, an unyielding commitment to the principles of academic freedom. What are they talking about here? They say that they're going to remedy this. Chancellor Wise, who fired Salida, said, we take this decision by the AAUP seriously. We understand that it will have repercussions on the scholarly activities of many in our community, and we intend to address both the censure and the underlying concerns through our established processes of shared governance. Well, can you decipher that for me? I mean, why haven't they offered Stephen Salida his job back? What are they talking about?
What they need to do is they need to undo the wrong they've done, and the only way to do that is to reinstate Professor Salida. This leads us to what happened on Saturday, which is why these statements are now being made. The American Association of University Professors censured the university, which is quite amazing, because of their termination of Professor Salida and because of the damage that does to academic freedom and to, principles of academic shared governance. University officials say, well, we'll look forward and we will do what we can, but they also say we are not reconsidering hiring Professor Salida. I mean, they did that. They said that even in response to their own Senate Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure's recommendation, which was to put the decision to a body of qualified academic experts and give Professor Salida an opportunity to respond. I mean, that recommendation was certainly not as strong as the AAUP's, and even that recommendation, the Board of Trustees resoundingly rejected, saying its decision was final. This February, the full faculty senate voted to call on the administration to promptly implement the CAFT findings. It's the Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure findings. Nothing. There's been nothing. So, they want to say what they can to try to not be censured, to sort of get their standing back and their reputation back, but they're not doing anything, and they're certainly not rehiring Professor Salida.
Marie, what is the effect of a censure?
I mean, first of all, there are 56 institutions currently on the list. There's no other Big Ten. The four universities that were just censured on Saturday, University of Illinois is by far the most prominent of the universities. Some universities have been on there for 50 years, religious institutions who have been censured for one reason or another. But, it is, you know, it demonstrates to the academic community and others that one cannot expect that academic freedom is respected at this university. So that could have, you know, that could have ramifications for faculty considering whether to stay there or to go there, even could have effects on students. It's most of all a very serious stain on the university's reputation and a public censure about their respect or lack thereof for academic freedom and shared governance.
What about the chilling effect? I mean, after all, Professor Salida, on his own time, on his own dime, on his own private tweet account, was protesting against the Israeli massacre in Gaza. After all, 500 children were killed by bombs from the Israelis. And he protested this in the strongest, even profane way.
Right.
But it was on his own time. This was not part of the university. So what about the chilling effect on, I mean, he was a guy that was supposed to have tenure, but what about the young professor? What about the students? I mean, what's the effect of this? And why do these universities, is it a question of money and they've got to grovel for money? Why do these universities do something so awful and then not back down?
Yeah. This is part of the broader context of nationwide attempts to suppress speech that's critical of Israel. I mean, the university has sort of changed its story along the way, but, you know, they deemed his speech uncivil. A couple of, you know, one of the trustees called it anti-Semitic. And, you know, then they said, well, it's not his views exactly, but the way he said them. Now they're claiming it would be disruptive to the university, but that's just, you know, the other side of the civility coin. CCR works closely with Palestine Legal, which has documented hundreds of incidents over the past couple of years where, you know, government entities, you know, Israel advocacy groups and others seek to suppress speech in favor of Palestinian rights. First 4 months of this year, Palestine Legal documented 60 incidents involving accusations of anti-Semitism made against student or faculty based solely on their speech that was critical of Israeli policy. So this is just, you know, and this is just this year. It has an alarming chilling effect, or it can have an alarming chilling effect, because there are, you know, areas like the topic of, you know, criticizing Israel, which is can be considered taboo. I mean, you've seen civility statements come out. You know, the response by Chancellor Wise in August was essentially a civility statement, which she's tried to walk back from and say, no, it wasn't a civility standard. But the university's own, again, their own CAF committee came out and said the civility is, you know, using a civility standard violates the Constitution. It contributes to academic freedom. It stifles debate. You have to look at the history of things like, you know, using terms like uncivil. You know, it's historically been used to ostracize entire groups. It was used to suppress the peaceful civil rights protests in the 60s. And it's being used now, both the label of incivility and the label of anti-Semitism, to attempt to silence speech that criticizes Israeli policy. And I think, you know, to the credit of activists and students and faculty, that speech isn't stopping. You know, the BDS movement is growing, and you know, it just shows how powerful it is, the level of suppression, trying to stop it. But that doesn't mean that it's not being chilled. You never really know how many people are prevented from speaking out and afraid to speak out because they see what happens to others.
Well, I'll give our listeners one example, Maria, and ask you to comment on it. One of the things that Professor Salida said that won him the accusation of being an anti-Semite, and this is during the bombing of the civilian population of Gaza. It was going on day after day after day. Salida tweeted the following. He said, "Zionists transforming anti-Semitism from something horrible into something honorable since 1948. Deconstruct that for us, please.
Well, you know, that was mostly misinterpreted. I mean, what he was saying, essentially, and he actually wrote an op-ed that explained that in part, is that the use of the label of anti-Semitism to to try to silence critics of Zionism or critics of international law violations undermines the fight against true anti-Semitism. It deflects and it undercuts what is real. I mean, when Palestinian rights activists are seeking, you know, justice and seeking equality and coming at it from an anti-racist, anti-oppression perspective, and then you have people trying to label criticism of Israel as anti-Semitism, it undercuts the whole struggle against anti-Semitism and other racism and bigotry.
I thought another reason for targeting Professor Salida was he's such a powerful scholar and speaker, and that his concerns were not only the concerns of Palestinians, after all his father was Jordanian, but also he was hired by the American Indian Studies Department, and he showed the parallels between the oppression of the colonized Palestinian people and what happened to Native Americans right here in our country. And he made those links, and I think that he was a real danger to people like the Zionists who would apologize for a colonial project.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's also good to point to the really overwhelming grassroots support there has been for him. Talking about what a sort of powerful speaker he is, since this has happened, he's been to over, 50 different campuses, giving lectures, meeting with people. There have been, over 5,000 professors have boycotted the university, including Cornell West, for its firing of him. 16 of the departments at the university have voted no confidence in the administration. And it's been, of course, it's been, widely condemned by various academic organizations, including now censured by the AUP. And yet still, it refuses to do the right thing. It certainly makes you wonder what's really going on.
What's the status of the litigation now, and where are we going, and how long do you think this might take? I mean, bring us up to date on that, please.
Well, we sued the university and university officials seeking Professor Salida's reinstatement and compensation for the damages he's suffered. So we sued claiming that for First Amendment retaliation, for violation of his due process. We also brought claims for breach of the contract he had with the university. The university and officials have moved to dismiss the complaint, arguing various things, including immunities. That's been fully briefed, and we're just waiting for the court to issue a decision. In the meantime, we're proceeding with discovery in the case. So we are moving forward.
And what about the tortious interference with his business contract? That after all, he had a contract to work there, and people came and got him fired. Who would be the target of that?
Well, those are the claims against the John Doe donors to the university, who were contributing large sums of money to the university and who threatened to withhold future donations to pressure the university to terminate Professor Salida. And we have not yet named those donors. So that's something that's also still waiting to happen.
And that will come up when the FOIA results.
Well, we are seeking information both through discovery in the case, but because some of that information we don't know could be subject possibly to a protective order, and because, the information that we're seeking in the FOIA case is really for the public interest, not for the litigation, but because people have a right to know how the university is making its decisions, and if it's making decisions to fire a faculty member because of donor pressure, some of that will come out through the FOIA case as well.
Maria, one of the fears that I have, I went to the University of Wisconsin in the state next door, and like the University of Illinois, it was one of those great state institutions. And now Scott Walker's cut the budget drastically and really doesn't seem to care if this great university just goes down the drain. And I understand that 86% of the finances from the University of Illinois are private finances, that we would thought superficially that this was a public university, but it's in large part financed privately. And that's what leads me to fear that the Board of Regents is just going to dig in its heels here and kowtow to the big money and not to genuine academic freedom.
It's right. You know, there's, I think it's only maybe 11 or 12% of the university's funds actually come from the state. And so we've actually argued that that the school then isn't entitled to sovereign immunity because it's not really a government organization in that way. But, you know, and that's one of the things that the new president of U of I, in response to the AUP censure, has also brought in the budget to this conversation, essentially seeking more certain funds from the state. I know that they had plenty of money to give a nice, I think it was, what, $160,000, $190,000 bonus to the outgoing president. You know, this is sort of the corporatization of the university conversation and the concern that not only is it running more like a corporation instead of the shared faculty governance that is what should happen in universities, but also that it's, you know, that the decisions could be so influenced by outside money. It is frightening.
Well, I think that's what makes this such an important case, Maria LaHood, and we're grateful for your being a guest on Law and Disorder and for your good legal work on the Stephen Salaita case. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maria.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.